This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It wasn't until I saw Justin Timberlake host Saturday Night Live that I realized what a great comic performer he is. And his performance in the new film, The Social Network, shows that he's a gifted dramatic actor. Many people his age, 29, or a little younger, were introduced to him when he was one of the stars of the new Mickey Mouse Club, along with Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, and Ryan Gosling. Then Timberlake was a member of the boy band NSYNC. He released his first solo album, Justified, in 2002. After his huge commercial success in music, he entered the world of independent film, co-starring in Alpha Dog and Black Snake Moan. Timberlake's new movie, The Social Network, is about the creation of Facebook and the rivalries, accusations, and lawsuits that followed. It was written by Aaron Sorkin and directed by David Fincher. Timberlake plays Sean Parker, the founder of Napster, who befriends Facebook's creator, Mark Zuckerberg, and finds the money to take Facebook from a college network to a global phenomenon. Parker also introduces Zuckerberg to the excesses of financial success, the girls and the parties. Here's a scene from the film. Sean Parker is in bed, introducing himself to the woman he's just spent the night with.
So what do you do?
I'm an entrepreneur.
You're unemployed.
I wouldn't say that.
What would you say?
That I'm an entrepreneur.
Well, then what was your latest preneur?
Well, I founded an internet company that let folks download and share music for free.
Kind of like Napster?
Exactly like Napster.
What do you mean?
I founded Napster.
Sean Parker founded Napster.
Nice to meet you.
Justin Timberlake, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure to have you here. So I read that David Fincher, the director, does like 80 takes of some scenes. Mm-hmm. How is that for you?
It's he does. You know, the first scene in the film with Jesse and Rooney Mara, it's sort of the scene that becomes the catalyst driving the whole film, and his obsession with creating something as big as a Facebook. I know that they shot that scene 99 times, and that might be the most takes he did for a scene, but yeah, he averages no less than 40 to 50. You know, when you come from the stage like I do, when you sort of put it that way, you rehearse. It's very similar to theater. You rehearse for a long amount of time and then you only get one take. And so to have 40, 50, 60, 70 takes sometimes in each scene, it was exhausting, but it was also very freeing because you felt like you could get out on the floor, so to speak, and let it mess up and find nuance. If David didn't afford us that opportunity, if we wouldn't have been able to layer these characters as much as we feel like hopefully we did.
So the character you play, Sean Parker, was a co-creator of Napster, and then he kind of came on board with Facebook and
right.
turned it into something huge because he got the financial backing to make it huge, and he had a huge vision for it. How much did you know about Sean Parker before playing him?
I didn't really know. I all of the actors in the film, we didn't know much about any of these guys. We came to these people as characters. You know, our first introduction to these people was the well-researched and specific characterization of them by Aaron Sorkin. And there was a book by Ben Mezrich that was being written sort of at the same time that Aaron was doing his research for the film. And I know that he did speak to a lot of people that, you know, their only condition was that they got to keep their anonymity. And I think none of us really asked questions about who or what he talked to or about with anyone. But, you know, suffice to say that he was very adamant about the fact that a lot of the research, even, you know, details of what they might have been drinking in a certain scene or the brand of clothing that they were wearing was all accounted for by his research.
You have become so good at comedy, and even in The Social Network, there are comedic touches, even though to your portrayal, even though the film is hardly a comedy. When did you start heading in that direction? Though I guess even on the Mickey Mouse Club, there were comedy sketches, but you just do seem to have a gift for comedy.
I guess for me, I've always thought that there was humor everywhere. And as a kid, I just, you know, I grew up an only child, and I sort of, nothing made me happier than to make my parents laugh. I remember I had costumes and things laying around the house that I would, you know, it just, anything that I could do to make my parents laugh.
What kind of costumes?
Oh, like I had a Jackson 5 wig that I would wear around, and I would do like the dances from the Jackson 5, and I'm, you know, my mother thought that was hysterical. So, of course, that seed got planted very early. The physicality of comedy you know, different things. I when I was a kid, I would impersonate anything that I would hear. It's actually, I attribute that more to why I actually was able to become a musician and a singer. I think I had a knack for music, but I think what I was more sort of talented at more than anything, because I don't think I'm a great singer. I think that I grew up imitating different voices that I heard. And when I was young, my mother, you know, used to listen to a lot of, there's a Southern rock station in Memphis that she listened to all the time. So I would imitate all of those voices that I heard when I was young. And when I was singing along with them on the radio. And so.
Well, along those lines, yeah, you were just on Jimmy Fallon's show, and you and he did a history of hip hop, and it was so great. And you did different voices in it, and let's hear some of that. And this is my guest, Justin Timberlake,
ladies and gentlemen, stupidity at its best.
No, it's great. it says Justin Timberlake and Jimmy Fallon doing a history of hip hop with the band The Roots, which is a great hip-hop band and is also the band on Jimmy Fallon's show. So here we go.
I said a hip-hop, a hip into the hip into the hip-hip-hop, and you don't stop.
Rock into the bang-bang, bang, sit up, jump, the boogie, rock the rhythm of the boogie beat.
Now what you get is not a test, I'm rapping the beat.
And me's the groove, and my friends are gonna try to move your feet.
Now beat a pipe of pick peppers,
go from rock rhyme,
Humpty Dumpty fell down.
It's our time.
Attack me nimble.
Whop nimble.
Anyone's quick.
But you're a master cut. Faster Jack Sardis.
Now here's a little story I got to tell about three bad brothers you know so well. It started way back in history with that right.
MCA and me, Mike D. On a war tour with Muhammad, my man. Going each and every place with the mic.
And Humpty Dance is your chance to do the hump.
Oh, do my baby.
I'll do the Humpty Hump. Watch me do the Humpty Hump.
It's a capital, yes, sir, yes, sir, press a double, B-O-D-O, double, G-Y-D-O, double, do you see?
Wow.
Justin Timberlake and Jimmy Fallon. And how did you both decide to do that sketch?
We knew that I was going to be on the show the next week, and we said, wow, we should come up with a bit to do. That would be really funny, and we were talking about a million different ideas, and I just remember blurting out, you remember that guy who did the history of dance or the evolution of dance? I can't remember exactly what it was called. I said, we should do the history of rap, because every time we're together, we sing songs as ridiculously as possible to try to make each other laugh. And that's where it came from. And you know, I think it should be noted as well, when you watch that back and listen to it, how amazing the Roots are. You know, it's almost like a DJ is spinning records back and forth. And to do that as a live band, it's, you know, they're peerless musicians to be able to pull that off. And honestly, I came in before we did the show, and we went out through it a couple of times back in their rehearsal area, and then we took it to the stage and did it a couple of times. And I think we decided too that if we did mess it up on live television, that would make it funny as well. So I think there was that element of that for us that made it exciting for us. And obviously Jimmy's great on SNL, and having, you know, that's kind of the same thing that you do on SNL, the element of anything could happen in the moment. I think that was exciting for us too. So
there's a Saturday Night Live song I want to ask you about, and this song is just so famous now. And I can't really say the full title of the song, But this is this is something that you did with Andy Samberg, and it's a parody of those narcissistic songs and videos in which the male singer thinks that the greatest gift he could give to a lady is his very special lovemaking. So
yes,
this song and video
that
is
was
about,
very eloquently put.
Thank you, thank you. This song and video is about presenting his girlfriend. I think it was right before Christmas that you did this. So the song and video is about presenting his girlfriend with his manhood in a gift wrap box. And it's the kind of love song where the singer is singing about how great he is, not how much he loves his girlfriend, but really how much he loves himself.
Right, right.
And this became one of the most viewed online things. It just went viral. So before we hear it, just tell us about writing this and performing it. It's so much fun. Go ahead.
The weird thing about the couple of things, digital shorts that I've done with Andy and the Lonely Island guys, is that it really, you know, for instance, we wrote the song in a delirium of no sleep on a Wednesday or Thursday of the week. And then we recorded it that night and we were laughing so hysterically. And like I said before, probably through the delirium of not being able to sleep and trying to write something funny, this came out of it. And we knew that it would be funny on some level because we were laughing with each other on the Friday that we filmed the video. And then Saturday morning, they edited it. And Saturday night, it was put out on television. So interestingly enough, how you described it, that these guys were so self-absorbed that there could never be a question in their mind that this wasn't the greatest Christmas gift of all time. And
are there just like so many songs, performers who seem to be that?
Well, maybe the song is funny to people because it speaks so much to the male population and how self-absorbed we all are.
And did you have any particular performers or songs in mind?
Oh, no. Well, the style. No, we weren't parodying anyone in particular. I think the style in which we were doing the song was we've made that pretty clear that it was early 90s R&B. But, you know, when we had that as a basis, then we said, well, OK, how ridiculous can we make this? And because then at that point, it's just about making it as funny as possible.
Well, let's hear it. This is this is Andy Samberg and my guest Justin Timberlake in the SNL video parody, and it's Blank in a Box.
Blank in a Box, well titled.
Hey, girl, I got something real important to give you, so just sit down and listen.
Girl, you know we've been together such a long, long time. Now I'm ready to lay it on the line.
Wow, you know it's Christmas and my heart is open wide. Gonna give you something so you know what's on my mind.
A gift real special, so take off the top.
Take a look inside, it's my in a box.
It's in a box.
That's my guest Justin Timberlake along with Andy Samberg in a sketch from Saturday Night Live, which is really, really funny.
I gotta tell you, I feel yeah. like I'm even getting away with something that just got played on NPR.
I wish we could say the title, but
I feel dirty. I feel dirty right now, and I apologize.
It's such a great sketch. Justin Timberlake is now one of the stars of the new movie The Social Network, which is about the founding of Facebook and all of the legal repercussions and the jealousies and resentments and lawsuits and so on that followed. So did you started performing when you were so young? I mean, if you go on the internet, people can see you at age 11 on Star Search, singing a country and western right. song. So, like, whose idea was it to start performing on TV that young? Was it you? Was it your parents?
As soon as I sort of discovered the stage, I think that it just brought out a lot in me that I didn't know that I had, and it did it at a very young age, and it was one of the most fun things that I could ever do. And so I begged my mother for voice lessons and guitar lessons and anything I could do to sort of, I wanted to be really good at it. I wanted to learn how to do it the right way. I knew that I had a good ear my father, my biological father, has an amazing voice, and music kind of runs in my family. But I knew that I wanted to learn. I knew that there was a sort of a right way to sing, and I wanted to learn that.
So, your grandfather was a Baptist minister, and I think your father now directs a church choir. Was the church your first stage?
It was. It was, actually. It was, my father doesn't do that anymore.
Oh, okay.
But he did at the time when I was very young. But it was the first time I had sort of stepped on stage to sing. And I don't know if you know much about a Southern Baptist church, but no one puts in a bad performance there. You know, it's a very nurturing place to step on a stage and sing, because even if you're really bad, people still say amen at the end. And
so what did you sing?
I can't remember what the songs were. I think there was something from the hymnal that I sang with my father, and I sang the harmony to something that he was singing, and that was my first sort of...
Of course. So you learned to harmonize in the church. That would make sense.
Right. I learned to harmonize listening to a choir sing, you know, three- and four-part harmonies, and so that's kind of where I got my ear from. But yeah, like I said, that's a very nurturing place to step on stage, because no one's going to get booed church.
So I watched the clip of you at age 11 on Star Search with Ed McMahon, and some really interesting things about that include that you're singing a country song, and you're dressed in right. kind of, you know, country clothing with the country kind of belt and the hat, mm. and... Mm. And the dancers
I appreciate you reminding me of all of this.
You're welcome, yes. But, you know, the funny thing, I love, like, kiddie talent shows, because what always okay. happens on those is that the children are coached by older people to perform like performers from older generations. And there's always some, like, really weird disconnect to see, like,
oh, right.
a 10-year-old pretending like he's Sammy Davis or something, you
right,
know?
A 10-year-old pretending like he's Alan Jackson.
Exactly. Thank you.
Right, right.
Yeah, so
right.
What was that like for you? I mean, to...
Well, it was a very surreal experience. I auditioned for that show at a mall in Memphis, Tennessee, at an open call audition, and... I mean, it was a line, you know, at that time, Star Search was our version of American Idol. It was the biggest talent show in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually auditioned with Percy Sledge's When a Man Loves a Woman. And then I went back and auditioned again, because you were allowed to audition as many times as you wanted with as many different things as you wanted. So I auditioned... if I can remember it correctly, I think it was a Garth Brooks song that I auditioned with too. But, you know, Garth Brooks was, like, you know, bigger than bubblegum at that time. And coming from Tennessee, it made sense to try that angle as well. And I got booked on the show. And it wasn't the song or performance that I wanted to do, but it was what they thought was crafted better for the television show. But I was happy to be there, and I was at Disney World, and I was 10, and, you know, I mean, it was a big deal for me, and if not for anything, I had a blast at the theme parks. So
okay, well, speaking of Disney World, you went on to be on the new Mickey Mouse Club, and what was the audition for that like?
Interestingly enough, this is some irony. The Disney MGM Studios, where Star Search was filmed, was a double soundstage, and next door to the soundstage of Star Search was the Disney Channel's new MMC. And so the serendipity of it is I lost the first round on Star Search, and we were on our way home. And there was an open call audition in Hendersonville, Tennessee. And it just came on the television in between commercials, and it said, open call audition at this place for the Disney Channel's MMC. And my mom said, you want to give it a go before we go home? And we're just going home. So I went in and auditioned for it, and then got a call back and went to sort of a casting camp like a week period of casting camp where, you know, all the kids who were sort of spawned out of that show, we met for the first time. Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and Ryan Gosling, and there were 21 kids who were whittled down by, I think, 20,000 that they had done auditions with all over the country. And out of those 21 kids, I think 7 of us were picked to be the new part of the cast. And when you're a kid and things like that happen, and it happens so fast, you know, you can't help but feel like, you know, something great was happening for you. But I look back on it, and I think it was more of a fluke than anything.
So after a couple of seasons on the Mickey Mouse Club, you ended up being in one of the famous boy bands, NSYNC, that was put together by Lou Pearlman, who also put together the Backstreet Boys and New Kids on the Block. So did that feel like a totally synthetic, or did it feel more organic as a group?
Well, it should be noted that Lou Pearlman didn't put us together, but did put up the money for us to.
Oh, I didn't realize that. So you created the.
Well,
you
I got a phone
yourself?
Call.
Yeah.
The show canceled, and then I went home for 2 years and got into trouble, and like, you know, preteens do, and in a small town in Tennessee. And then all of a sudden one day I got a call from Chris Kirkpatrick. He called my mother and said that he was putting together something. And that there was a person in Orlando who would finance the whole thing, and the money was put up. But you know, after I took the trip down there to meet him, at the same time I said, ironically, JC, who was on the show as well, we were in Nashville cutting demos and starting to write music together. And so when I got that phone call, I said to Chris, you know, I actually know someone who probably would obviously has an amazing voice and is a very gifted musician and would be great for the group. And let me ask him if he's interested as well. So JC and I actually went down to Orlando together, and we met Chris. And in the process of that, we started just forming the group. And everything that we did was based around a cappella harmonies. That's mm-hmm. that's what we wanted to be in the beginning. We sort of wanted to be an a cappella group. And so that was why we put 5 guys in the group. And when we were forming the group, there wasn't a boy band phenomenon. You know, Nirvana was – and Pearl Jam were probably the top 2 acts in the world at the time. And, you know, we never knew at what capacity everything was going to work out for us. I don't think that we thought it was going to be as big as it became.
You've talked a little bit about singing and learning to sing when you were young. What about dancing? Like, did you study dancing? Did you study with break dancers or with more traditional choreographers?
I wish that I would have taken more, I guess there's still time, but I wish that I would have taken more technical dance. I'd taken a couple of technical dance classes, but I learned more how to dance just as a product of watching MTV and being around, like you said, break dancers and clubs. You know, break dancing was hugely b-boying, as it's sort of more accurately called by the culture, as it was very popular at the time. So I was really, really into it. I thought it was just phenomenal. And I learned more probably about how to dance in watching and studying them.
What's something that you tried to do but that was just going too far for you?
Yeah, no, I remember I really started getting into breakdancing pretty hard and learning the technicality of it. I broke my thumb twice in a row. And I think that's when I said, you know, I think I'm just going to stay on my feet. I'm going to keep my feet below my head as it's intended.
Were you trying to spin on your head or something when that happened?
Yeah. My head spun me instead of me spinning on my head. It was, wasn't a pretty sight. So I think right then and there I decided that I would sort of, you know, I find that every time I write music or come up with an idea for a record, that whatever it is that I come up with, I feel like I have a specific aesthetic that goes with it, very much like creating a character. I find that I describe that to people, and sometimes they respond to it and sometimes they don't. But for instance, my last album, Future Sex Love Sounds, was a character that I created, much like obviously not the same way that David Bowie would create something like Ziggy Stardust, something that aspired to be a character.
What was the character that you were seeing?
I don't know. I just saw it as someone who I saw. I guess for some reason I saw some mixture between like 007 character, right. but also an ode to like Fred Astaire. Mm-hmm. In a way, or Gene Kelly. I think I saw it as an ode to that, but how could I take that and make it sound modern? And so when the aesthetic of it came into play, I wanted to play the part. I wanted to play it. I did feel like I was creating sort of a character that could maybe fall into a Kubrick film or a Helmut Newton photo or... You know, I just saw a lot of images in my mind after we had looked back and created it.
Well, let's take Sexy Back as an example. Your voice is processed on part of that. Why did you want that?
You know, it was a song. I'm not actually even singing on the song. You know,
what does that mean? When,
well, I'm more sort of talking in tone. More than singing in that song. I mean, it's all I can tell you is that the day before we did that song, I was listening to David Bowie's Rebel Rebel, and I'm sure that when people hear me say that, it sounds almost sacrilegious. Because I mean, I think the world of his musicianship, but just the feeling that I got from that song, there was something so unabashed about that record and his performance on that record. And there were parts of that song where I felt like, oh, he's not even singing. He's just expressing himself through rhythm and tone. And that's what I wanted to capture with that song. And I don't know where that line came from. I sometimes regret it because I feel like people feel like it's an extension of who I am. But when I feel like when I get the opportunity to tell them that I felt like I was playing a character, sometimes they get it and sometimes they don't. And, you know, for whatever reason, when we started recording it, I wanted the vocal to sort of almost slap you in the face. I wanted it to sound like it was distorted. So I just got the idea that what if we put it through a simulated guitar amp or an effect like that. So it really has it's a very sparse sounding record because there's no in between the parts that I'm actually – performing the record, there's just the sound of these weird, quirky, computerized gimmicks. I felt like if anyone ever took dance music and applied a rock and roll frame of mind to it, with bravado and sort of rock star-ism, that's what we were trying to capture, and it was just a moment. And originally the song wasn't going to be called that because I thought that was too on the nose, but I just found that the more I played it for people around me, that's what they called it. I sometimes regret that I wrote it that way, but also not, because it was a moment and it was fun and I had fun writing it. And when I see people sing it back to me, you know, when you play, for instance, cut to me standing on stage in Copenhagen for 80,000 people and they're all singing the song, and there's something so unabashed and fun and unbridled about their feeling with that song. So I felt like it was mission accomplished.
Okay, so after that great description, we have to hear it. This is my guest, Justin Timberlake, singing Sexy Back. Thank you.
the sexy back.
Yeah.
The mother boys don't know how to act.
Yeah.
I think it's special what's behind your back.
Yeah.
So turn around and I'll pick up the slack.
Yeah. Take a piece of bridge.
Dirty babe. You see these shackles, baby, on this slave. I'll let you with me if I misbehave.
That was Justin Timberlake, recorded in 2006, one of his big solo hits. And Justin Timberlake is now one of the stars of the new movie, The Social Network, about the founding of Facebook. And he plays the founder of Napster. So that's really fun to listen back to. what was it like for you going solo as opposed to like being in a group? You know, being more having all the responsibility, the main responsibility on your shoulders.
Well, it was comfortable. I think growing up as an only child probably had more to do with that than anything. But, you know, I've stated this in the past that I felt like I had grown up in the group, and in becoming a young man, I had music that I was ready to express, and I don't think it was an extension of the other guys in the group. And so I think it was a natural progression. There was timing that was involved with some of the other guys aspiring to do other things as well. And so there was a little bit of serendipity to that. But also I think naturally it still would have taken its course that I would have ended up doing solo work just because I think that I had different music inside of me that I wanted to express.
So you are so lucky. You were a child star and survived. I mean, seriously, like the things that you learned as a child star were probably like so helpful in learning, you know, like show business and dancing and singing and acting. But at the same time, it ruins so many people. Like so many people who are lucky enough to have that kind of early fame never recover. So do you have any sense of what it was that has kept you?
I think I would just chalk that up to amazing parents, an amazing mother. You know, my
I hope
parents,
she's listening.
I'm almost positive she's listening right now. She's very proud, but I would chalk that up to an amazing mother. She's you know, my biological parents divorced when I was right around the time I turned one, and my mother remarried my stepdad when I was five, and right after I turned five. And so, you know, there was a period of time where I had to get used to sort of a man that wasn't related to me by blood. And you know, she always made everything so comfortable for me, and she always spoke to me like I was her peer. And I remember her saying, you know, I think the thing that she's sort of embedded in my brain is if you have the ability to do something, one or two things, great. It doesn't mean that you're a better person than anyone else. And I think that I've held on to that. And I think that the accolades that I receive personally from what I do are more comments you would get from people that say your music helped them through a rough time, or saying that you made them laugh, or saying that they thought you know, something you did was great, rather than, you know, materialistic awards or things like that. But I would chalk it up to a great mother who's always taught me that we all put our pants on one leg at a time. So,
well, Justin Timberlake, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm such a fan, and I was so excited to be on the show.
I'm
so
very excited to hear you say that. Justin Timberlake co-stars in the new film The Social Network. He plays Sean Parker, the founder of Napster. You can listen to several Justin Timberlake songs and find links to his digital SNL shorts on our website, freshair.npr.org. Sarah Blasco is a singer-songwriter from Sydney, Australia, who recently made her American debut with her third album, As Day Follows Night. Blasco says it's a cycle of songs about a love triangle done in the manner of early Carole King and Leonard Cohen. Music critic Milo Miles has a review.
Start talking about Sarah Blasco's As Day Follows Night by noting how a music critic can introduce you to a record that delights you. Partly in thanks, partly because it doesn't happen to me as much as it used to. The critic in question is Blasco's fellow Australian Robert Forster, formerly one of the songwriting co-leaders of the Go-Betweens. Turns out he's an astute, articulate judge of other musicians' work. And without the Blasco review in Forster's book, The 10 Rules of Rock and Roll, I never would have picked up on As Day Follows Night. When you're in sync with a music writer, you usually have one of two responses to his observations. Either, I hear what you hear, but it doesn't mean the same thing to me, or I hear what you hear, and I'm with you. Forster got me to listen to Blasco by selling her through the basics, her sound and her words. The sound springs from Blasco's collaboration with Swedish producer Björn Utling. I know, I'd never heard of him either. A good shorthand way to explain his approach is to say that he frames voices and songs rather like the American John Bryan, who has a flair for producing singer-songwriters like Amy Mann and Rufus Wainwright. On As Day Follows Night, you feel intimate with the singer's voice right away, and only later notice inventive music touches that round out everything, like the brilliant musical Saw on All I Want.
I don't want another lover, so don't keep holding out your hands. There's no room beside me. I'm not looking for romance. Say I'll be here, I'll be here, but there's no way you'd understand. All I want, all I want, all I want, when I don't myself.
There's rare pleasures in the plainness and specifics of Blasco lines like, when all your life you waited for someone to understand, to wake you up and speak your name. Blasco's theme is as old as romance itself, an intricate, volatile relationship that alternates between joyful affirmation and collapse. Relationship albums may seem obvious undertakings, but they are challenging. Earlier this year, the gifted Tracy Thorn released a similar-themed album that was flatter and more predictable than As Day Follows Night. Part of the reason Blasco succeeds is old-fashioned warmth and soul, but part is melodies that tug hard on the ear. Catchiness isn't everything. By itself, it can be mechanical. But if touched by verve and savvy, catchiness is an asset. And after a couple listens, you will recognize every track on Blasco's album with pleasure. Even the anguish of I Never Knew.
It's not enough. It's not enough for both of us. This love I feel won't reach into your heart. Though it hurts inside to find my pride so alive.
wouldn't expect an introspective album about love torments to be headlong rocking. But more important, Blasco avoids the temptation to be too slow and sluggish, of confusing meditation with moping. You don't expect a happy ending to the romance exactly, but Blasco makes you pull for her happiness with determined numbers like No Turning Back, which makes letdowns like Lost and Defeated cut with jagged edges. Then, at the last moment, in the wistful finale Night and Day, Blasco affirms that whatever the outcome of love, the game is worth it, and you accept that's happiness enough.
Milo Miles reviewed As Day Follows Night from Sarah Blasco. You can listen to three tracks from it on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our TV critic David Bianculli recently looked ahead at what the networks had to offer for the fall season. Today, though, he's looking back, way back, half a century or more, and he's wondering why some TV programmers aren't doing the same.
That music may not conjure up any memories for you, especially if you're under 30. But to most older listeners, ones about my age, that's instantly recognizable as the theme song to TV's My Three Sons. It's a tune all but guaranteed to start your toes tapping. And it may even conjure up long dormant images of the animated opening credits where cartoon toes were tapping. There's value in these old shows. Not just because the best of them were and are entertaining, but because they provide a snapshot of what we were, what we accepted, and what, in some cases, we aspired to become. I mention this not because of a general wave of nostalgia, but because of a very specific wave. Last Wednesday, My Three Sons, a gentle ABC sitcom starring Fred McMurray as a single father raising three boys, turned 50 years old. I would say it celebrated its golden anniversary, except I couldn't find any celebration. Not on ABC, which wasn't about to waste valuable prime time on a show that premiered before the oldest person in the network's coveted 18 to 49 demographic was even born. Not on TV Land, which you'd think would be a natural, or even on Nick at Night. No, even on cable networks devoted to vintage TV, vintage, these days, means the George Lopez Show. And I'm not kidding. My Three Sons, by the way, is by no means an isolated case of TV disregarding its own past. Last Sunday, CBS's The Andy Griffith Show, one of TV's most durable, popular, and iconic weekly programs, turned 50. TV Land, at least, showed a four-hour block of episodes that day to honor the event, but it made sure the celebration was over before primetime. The Flintstones turned 50 last week, and only the Boomerang cable network seemed to care. ABC's Beulah, the first TV sitcom to star an African-American, turned 60 last weekend. But not even BET bothered to present an episode. And yesterday was the 60th anniversary of the delightful game show hosted by Groucho Marx, You Bet Your Life. And I bet your life you didn't know that. Next month is the golden anniversary of one of the most important TV documentaries ever shown, Edward R. Murrow's Harvest of Shame, about migrant workers, originally shown Thanksgiving weekend on CBS. It's been out on video for years, but if no one sees it, that's the same as being lost and forgotten. The same goes for a show that turns 60 next Tuesday, a CBS series that was the pivotal missing link between vaudeville, radio, and what evolved into the TV sitcom, The George Burns and Gracie Allen Show. This was when George Burns was relatively young. TV, too. The stage sets of George and Gracie's house had only three walls, so studio audiences could see the stars. Mentions of the commercial sponsor, Carnation Evaporated Milk, were folded right into the show's dialogue. Gracie, effortlessly bringing to TV her radio role of a ditzy dame, would wonder how they managed to get milk from carnations. But the central DNA of television situation comedy is all here. The neighbor who bursts in unannounced, the schemes that don't work, the husband who thinks he knows best but often doesn't. And after 60 years, the comedy is still funny. For example, the scene where Gracie visits a friend in the hospital and returns home with a bouquet of flowers. And yes, they're carnations. It always gets a big laugh from the college students in my TV history class.
Why, what beautiful flowers.
Aren't they lovely? And if it weren't for you, I wouldn't have them.
Me? Mm-hmm. What did I have to do with this?
Well, it was your idea. You said when I went to visit Clara Bagley to take her flowers, so when she wasn't looking, I did.
Gracie, I said for you to stop.
Well, isn't it good that carnation's there? I'll put them in the refrigerator. We'll milk them later.
We'll milk them later. Well, I guess if she made sense, I'd still be selling ties.
So where is this going to be shown on TV next week? So far as I can tell, nowhere. And that's a shame. For movie fans, Turner Classic Movies is the perfect cable network. It shows films unedited and uninterrupted and has a host on hand to put things in context. It even has a weekend showcase called The Essentials, where Robert Osborne and guest host Alec Baldwin present certain movies and talk about why they love them. Where's the TV equivalent when more programs are celebrating key anniversaries every year? If we forget our TV history, we're doomed to no repeats.
David Bianculli is founder and editor of the website TVWorthWatching.com, and he teaches TV and film history at Rowan University in New Jersey.